are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 4th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. I'm Michael Monday on Tuesday. Derek Davidson, journalist, foreign policy analyst, he's joining us to talk about Trump's war on civilians, re-engineering the rules of engagement, leading to more civilian deaths in Yemen, Iraq, Somalia. Also, how is Trump undermining the Iran deal? What's the appetite for changing the Iran deal in Iran? And what exactly is this meeting that happened in the Seychelles, facilitated by the United Arab Emirates and Eric Prince, the Blackwater guy, between representatives of Trump and a confidant of Vladimir Putin? Hint, it has to do with Iran. Not too much of a hint. That actually is most of the story. And journalist Corey Pine, writer for The Baffler, author of forthcoming book on Silicon Valley, will talk with us about the Dark Enlightenment and the pseudo-intellectual neo-fascist gobbledygook that Peter Thiel and other dangerous people from the tech industry read and fund. Auditions from bloggers to be philosopher kings to the new fascist elite. Steve Bannon got the gig, and we're not even in fascist elite yet. We're still at clown fascism. Also, destroy America's health, round two. Trump administration meeting with members of the Freedom Caucus with the so-called Republican moderates to do another push on getting rid of Obamacare. Do they have a shot? Probably not, but they're making an effort. We're closer to getting rid of the filibuster in order to confirm Neil Gorsuch, because all Democrats, except for four, are going to hold strong and filibuster Neil Gorsuch, this extremist judge, and Dr. Gorka. He's in the news again for some recent activities, one of which may have had to do with some covert strategic work that he engaged in on Wikipedia. And NYPD might have violated its own rules on intelligence sharing by planting undercovers and spying on Black Lives Matter activists. All that and more on today's Majority Report. I'm not going to be speaking from experience here, but I could say I've missed important dates. And I have to ask, have any of you ever forgot an anniversary? Or you know people that are just hard to shop for? Like someone important in your life's birthday, again, perhaps an anniversary. And it's just the worst trying to find a gift that will A, they will like, and B, won't cost an arm and a leg, won't cost a ton of money. Well, I'm going to make it easy for you. Pro Flowers is my go-to for flowers. They're fresh, priced right, and a perfect gift for literally anyone. And they get delivered straight to the recipient's door. How easy is that? And right now, Pro Flowers has a special offer just for our listeners. Get $10 off of your first purchase of $29 or more. This deal works on best-selling gifts like their 100 Blooms Bouquet, a dozen red roses, or even their totally unique plant gifts. To snag this great deal, just go to proflowers.com and enter code CEDER, S-E-D-E-R, at checkout. Pro Flowers bouquets are guaranteed fresh for 7 days or your money back. They have a 7-step quality check, which means the flowers are always awesome. Their website is super easy to use. This is true. I have actually successfully navigated and used this website. My flowers are on the way. Mom. Good thing that she does not watch or listen to this program. It'll still be a surprise. The website's super easy to use, and you can schedule. Actually, she doesn't when I host, so I guess surprise out of the bag. Schedule your delivery ahead of time for any date you want and get it and get back to your day. ProFlowers is a no-brainer gift for birthday and anniversary, every occasion. Like actually what I'm using it for now with my mom. Just send her some flowers. She's great. Love my mom. Or for no occasion at all. Anytime you want her or him to feel special, they will take care of all the details. Do yourself a favor and help out our show by supporting ProFlowers. I know you have a birthday or anniversary coming up, so right now get $10 off your first purchase of $29 or more at ProFlowers. But this deal won't last long. Just go to ProFlowers.com, enter code CEDAR at checkout, and get the special deal. Now, we've been talking with you for a long time about the special deal that is known as MeUndies. Matt, how far ahead of the curve are you on this?
Well, I am familiar with the textile that they use to make their underwear. Modal, they call it. They might actually call it micromodal, and it might be an improvement on the modal that I came across in 2011 as I was in London. So,
Dope Boy. Hashtag #2DopeBoys in a podcast. If you've been settling for store-bought underwear or 5-packs, I have something that will change your life for the better. MeUndies. What is MeUndies? Just seriously soft, feel-good underwear that gets delivered right to your door. Designed in L.A. and made from sustainably sourced micromodal, the fabric that's 3 times softer than cotton. It's really, really soft. I can also attest. MeUndies is softer than soft. Luxe Undies comes in ever-changing selection of classic colors, bold shades, and adventurous patterns that you can tailor to your own personal style. And guess what? You can save 33% each month with a monthly subscription. Simply select your style and size and plan, and MeUndies will send you undies that they'll think you'll swoon for each month. And if you're not ready for a subscription, that's okay. You can still save because MeUndies is offering you 20% off your first pair. Just use our special URL, MeUndies, that's MeUndies.com/majority, get 20% off your first pair. So go ahead, revamp your underwear draw. You deserve it. Once again, it's MeUndies.com/majority, MeUndies.com/majority. Let's get to the sound. So Bill O'Reilly, who it's long been known that he's a terrible person, that obviously Fox News has a systemic sexual harassment culture or alpha male culture, whatever. This is a country of great cons that a bunch of pasty, repulsive drunks who are harassing and disrespectful and despicable human beings could somehow build a narrative where that was somehow powerful and proactive behavior. So we last heard the story of Wendy Walsh, I believe her name is. This is a woman who Bill O'Reilly was going to turn into a contributor on his show. He's going to put in a good word with her with Roger Ailes. Jesus Christ, what the hell does that mean? And when she rebuffed his advances at a hotel, he walked off and he said, "Your purse is ugly. It's an ugly purse. You can forget the career advice. Welcome back to The Factor." And now on CNN with Don Lemon, Don Lemon hosted Wendy Walsh herself, along with, I believe this is either a confidant of hers or an attorney. No word in this clip. It's worth listening to and watching just to really get a sense of how disgusting the behavior was. No word on whether she's upped her purse game or not.
You know, we've known each other for years. But mm-hmm. The first I learned about this encounter with Bill O'Reilly was when I read it in the New York Times this weekend, and I was just flabbergasted. Tell me what happened.
Well, in a nutshell, I was asked to be on his show as a regular guest, and 3 weeks into it, I got you know, kind of an exciting email from his secretary saying, Mr. O'Reilly's coming out to Los Angeles and he'd like to have dinner with you. I said, absolutely, because I wanted to talk to him about my career prospects. Often being brought on as a guest is kind of an audition process, and I wanted to be a paid contributor. I didn't have to bring it up because he brought it up at the beginning of the dinner, basically said Roger Ailes is a good friend of his and they plan on making me a contributor. And so I was very happy. The dinner went on to include a lot of small talk, as people, adults do at the dinner table, about life, love, etc. And then at the end of the dinner, he simply said, let's get out of here. And as we walked out of the restaurant at the Bel Air Hotel, he walked to the right towards the hotel rooms. I walked to the left towards the bar. And there was this awkward moment where we couldn't find each other. And then he caught up with me and said, no, come back to my suite. And I simply said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. Hmm. And he said, what? You think I'm going to attack you? And so anyway, at that point, he became hostile. And then he spent some time weaning me off the show and getting his executive producer to cancel me.
So did you continue speaking with him that night, right?
Yes. So we went into the bar and he complained that the soda water I ordered was too expensive and my purse was really ugly. I guess he's a fashion
connoisseur. So that's how he treated you for the rest of the evening.
Bill O'Reilly's garbage. And he's still on Fox News. A couple of sponsors, including Mercedes and Hyundai, have dropped. And of course he's still on Fox News because clearly inside that organization, this is a feature, not a bug.
And Mercedes-Benz is stuck by some pretty shady characters in the past, so if they're sticking by O'Reilly.
Well, you can still make a car for Hitler. Can't do it for me. Life insurance. Do you have it? If you don't, why not? Too expensive or a hassle? If you don't have life insurance, what would happen to, financially if something happened to the primary earner? Policygenius.com is the best online life insurance marketplace, the most accurate quotes from top A-rated life insurance companies. Policygenius has over $5 billion in life insurance for people like you. Policygenius has a very simple, user-friendly website to shop and compare all top-rated insurance plans and give you the best options. They have a licensed customer service team to help you find the best policy at the best price. While you're there, check out their other insurance offerings like pet insurance. Go to policygenius.com to save 40% off of other prices for life insurance. When life insurers compete for your business, you save money. That's policygenius.com. Zero jargon, zero sales pressure, zero hassle. Life insurance made easy, free quotes, zero hassle, peace of mind. Don't wait. Go to policygenius.com. And finally, really brief, we're about to get to Derek Davidson, but of course, we've got the awesome justcoffee.coop deal going all this going now. You just go to justcoffee.coop and you can order the MR coffee blend with code MRSPRING17. That's MRSPRING17. There's also code is up on our website. Get yourself some great coffee today. 30% off. We'll be right back with Derek Davidson.
What they gonna do when enough of them not true? Say what they gonna do, them get slow, yeah. Who do you think you are? We're living in a small world. Smile on my face, that day will come when I stand and see all those big
wicked men end up high and getting burned. That day will come when they will try to escape and there will be nowhere to run. That day will come when I shall see they handing over bombs and bayonets and bullets and guns. That day will come when Emperor Selassie I shall rise the world they get to do them out of this slum.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Derek Davidson. He's a foreign policy analyst and writer with a specialty in the Middle East. Derek, how you doing, man?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Doing really well. It's good to be talking with you. I've always appreciated your work wherever I've found it, including, I guess, a lot of it actually on Loblog,
which I'm a fan of. Right, right. Other than my own blog, that's pretty much the best place to find me.
Okay, great. So, and we'll have links to all of that on our website. I want to start, you have a recent piece, and we've talked mm-hmm. about this a little bit on the show, but I want to get into some sort of greater details for people to understand. It sort of goes without saying that obviously any type of military engagement, period, can and does result in the killing of innocents and civilian casualties. Certainly, the Obama administration was responsible for, you know, civilian casualties like any other administration. But Donald Trump is proving actually in a very bizarre and sick way, like he's keeping his word when his word was we got to bomb the shit out of people. You have a new piece in
right.
Loblog.
Yeah, he didn't specify who the people were.
No, he didn't.
Yeah,
Trump's
exactly.
Trump takes the gloves off. Punches civilians. Explain what that means.
Well, so there's been this pattern, especially the last few weeks, of strikes, U.S. strikes, that have caused a lot of civilian casualties, both in Syria and Iraq. And I actually took, in the piece, I go all the way back to the January Navy SEAL raid in Yemen that killed up to 30 civilians, depending on you know whose estimates you look at.
Right.
And then we know that around that same time, actually the day before the raid, Trump signed a memorandum, a national security memorandum, where he asked the Pentagon to give him a plan to defeat ISIS within the next 30 days. And mentioned in that memorandum is that he wanted changes to rules of engagement that might exceed the requirements of international law, which is, you know, legalese for, you know, how far can we push the envelope in terms of, you know, what kind of strikes we authorize and what the collateral damage is.
What's the contrast between that and the Obama administration? I mean, there's kind of two tracks. One, I would think, just in terms of escalation of engagement, period. But on the other hand, you would think of, you know, there's these reports coming out with drones specifically that was obviously the sort of preferred instrument of the Obama people. That Trump, you know, this also very much applies to drone strikes. But, you know, that said, you did have those signature strikes that they engaged in a lot, particularly earlier in the administration, which were sort of based on behavioral patterning, which in some ways almost definitionally makes it so that you can't even measure whether or not you're killing civilians because you don't actually exactly know who you're hitting. You're just hitting a behavioral profile.
Right. And they, I mean, they, you know, their operating procedure was to define any adult-aged male in the vicinity of a strike as a terrorist until, you know, proven otherwise, or insurgent until proven otherwise. So, yeah, I mean, certainly the, you know, none of this is to defend anything about the Obama drone program. But, you know, just, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, on Twitter, Micah Zenko, who's from the Council on Foreign Relations, posted a count comparing the Trump administration's strikes in Yemen to the Obama administration's airstrikes, you know, across the sort of all the countries that we've decreed as active conflict zones. And there's no comparison. I mean, Trump has struck Yemen right now, you know, once for every day he's been in office. And, you know, that's a obviously huge escalation from the rate that we were striking places under Obama.
I'm going to phrase this in a kind of like emotive way, I guess, but does it kind of piss you off that there were some people that, you know, and I think generally I would agree with their critiques of Obama and Hillary Clinton's foreign policies, that they somehow allowed some comments that Trump would make, which were never about, like, you know, he would say things like he even did a couple months ago, like, oh, you think we're so innocent with regards to Putin's human rights record. Now, you know, some people, it was like almost like, oh my God, this is real estate scumbag Noam Chomsky. But actually, he was saying something entirely different than critics of U.S. foreign policy and abuses were saying. They would say, we do these things, we should stop them. He's saying, we all do this, so I'm not even going to pretend to moralize.
And right, let's just lean into it and do it. Yeah, yeah.
So does that like...
Right,
a, yeah, go ahead.
It's aggravating. I mean, I wrote about that before the election. You know, this sort of strain of what I call broadly, you know, the anti-war movement that had decided they had adopted Trump as their, you know, the less violent candidate, which, you know, again, the critiques of Hillary Clinton, I think, were fair and accurate. But to say that Trump was going to be somehow less antagonistic or less violent was to ignore a lot of the things that he said during the campaign and just, you know, what we know about him in general.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have these kind of like broad sets of delusions about Donald Trump. The delusion that some people on the left somehow got, you know, dragged into is that somehow he was going to be less militarily inclined, which, you know, always struck me as completely delusional. And obviously, tragically, it was and it is. Then we got the whole, you know, Russia obsession. And I'm not somebody who thinks that there's no there. I think that the there is probably going to be something more prosaic. You know, it probably have more to do with like money laundering and that type of thing than espionage.
Yeah, with his finances.
Yeah, I think, and I definitely think that there is some fire there. But we have this story that came out about Eric Prince in the United Arab Emirates facilitating some back-channel meetings between people representing Donald Trump and confidants of Vladimir Putin. And, you know, I want to set the stage for you, but what's so interesting about it is that it actually illustrates so many great things. One is everybody should go down the rabbit hole of looking at the relationship between Eric Prince and Blackwater and the United Arab Emirates. They have hundreds of millions of dollars of contracts there for the Emirates. And the United Arab Emirates is one of the first and only Middle Eastern states when Trump was elected to you know, kind of officially say, like, yeah, we don't have a problem with the Muslim ban. I think they were actually the only one, in fact. And, you know, you have all of this kind of sleaziness and the Blackwater role, but it seems like from the report, there actually was a substantive purpose to this meeting. And the substantive purpose was to basically try to get Russia to pivot away from Iran so as to, you know, leave Iran more exposed to the U.S. and to bring Russia and the U.S. closer, which for whatever reason does seem to be the approach of the Trump administration. And I want you to comment on that, including just like the part of it that to me demonstrates, again, for all of this like sleaziness and money washing around, like these guys just don't really get how things work. Like, you know, what would it actually take to get Russia and Iran to separate when they have an incredibly successful mutually beneficial relationship?
Right. So a lot of this, I think, you need to understand in terms of wishful thinking. you know, the separation, the idea of creating daylight or exploiting daylight between Russia and Iran is sort of the key that would fix all the internal inherent contradictions in what Trump's foreign policy seems to be. You know, where they want to rebuild relations with Russia, but they want to ratchet up again tensions with Iran. They want to not pay attention to Assad. I mean, you know, we've had Nikki Haley over the past week has, you know, she's had a different administration position on Bashar al-Assad every day, basically, for the last week. You know, they don't want to make him a priority, but they don't want him to stay after the civil war is over. They've got a lot of balls in the air, I guess, that you know, if they could somehow separate Russia and Iran and bring Russia into the, you know, into their orbit, or come, you know, sort of create a mutual relationship there, that would solve a lot of problems for them. But it relies, you know, the idea that you can separate these two countries relies on a lot of assumptions that I think are pipe dreams, in a sense, and particularly given the political climate now with all the investigations and, you know, how much the Trump administration can realistically be seen to be doing favors for the Russians, or, you know, making policy that's beneficial to Russia. There is a history of tension in the Russia-Iran relationship. I mean, you can go back centuries if you want, but we can talk about just since the revolution. I mean, you know, the Soviets supported Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War. You know, there have been antagonistic relationships about Azerbaijan and, you know, Iran, the historical Azerbaijan, part of it's in Iran and part of it was in the Soviet Union, and there were, you know, push and pull relationships about that. Then, you know, if you fast forward to the 2000s, there was a case in the early 2000s, around 2003, where Moscow partially reneged on a deal that it had with Iran on supplying Iran with uranium fuel for its civilian nuclear program, partly because of concerns about, you know, the possibility of an Iranian nuclear weapons program, and partly because at the time they thought that doing that would improve their relationship with the United States.
Right.
So this isn't something that they're just sort of inventing out of nowhere, but it ignores the fact that we've had a lot of things happen since the early 2000s. For one thing, you know, the Russians, I'm sure, feel like, you know, they pulled out of an economically beneficial agreement with Iran to supply them with the nuclear fuel, and then got burned, you know, with what happened in Ukraine and all the sanctions that were imposed after that. So there, you know, and then, you know, we also have to talk about Syria and the fact that, as you say, they have this very strong mutual, you know, relationship in Syria and a mutually beneficial relationship supporting Assad. So I think in theory, you could probably do this. You could probably leverage some daylight between, Moscow and Tehran. They don't have exactly the same aims in Syria. You could exploit that. Mm-hmm. Russia has a lot of things that it wants. It wants to be treated as a superpower again, which, you know, they'll paradoxically want. I mean, despite all the sort of opposition that Vladimir Putin has offered to, you know, pretty much anything the United States is doing in the world these days, you know, the paradoxical thing is that they would happily accept the path back to superpower status that involves a partnership with the United States instead of, you know, this antagonistic relationship.
Right.
But they would want so much at this point. I mean, they would want recognition of the Crimea annexation. They would want, you know, complete lifting of sanctions, and, you know, probably more besides that. I mean, those would be the two big things. They would want assurances in Syria that their interests will be taken care of in, you know, whatever government emerges after the civil war. You know, so they've got a long list of things that they would want, some of which would not be the greatest, it would not be a great idea for the United States to give to them, particularly, you know, I think recognizing the Crimea annexation is a very slippery slope.
Do you think,
politically, you know, as I alluded to a little bit ago, politically, it's impossible for the Trump administration now, given all this stuff that's in the air in D.C. about, you know, their ties to Russia, it would be impossible for them to do any of these things without, you know, incurring, you know, even more scrutiny.
Yeah, the sort of irony is that, and I just, you know, we'll get into a second some of the specific ways that Iran and the United States now are positioned in terms of the deal and what Trump could do to undermine it and what the Iranian position is. But this is another thing that annoys me on a certain, you know, or anytime Russia comes up, I feel like you honestly are one of the only people who are in media that doesn't become stupid, because Russia just makes people morons. And anytime, like, because, you know, there's people who are like, you know, people who devised like a failed Clinton digital strategy, and all of a sudden, like, you know, Vladimir Putin explains how they managed to screw this election up. You got, you know, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who, you know, clearly have something that's bizarre Cold War fetish. And then conversely, you know, you have people who would condemn categorically and should and rightly all of the atrocities that the United States commits across the world. And then when Russia is, you know, carpet bombing people in Syria, then all of a sudden they're actually, well, ironically, you know, fighting terrorism, which is certainly never an excuse that would work when we're talking about a U.S. president. And or, you know, or secondly, like, they're actually helping liberate, which is ironic because they're actually, Russia gets to have the two BS arguments that we dismiss from the United States, which is, it's okay because it's national security or it's humanitarian intervention. When a U.S. administration posits those arguments, it's always a lie to, you know, cover for narrow self-interest and disregard for civilians. But for some reason, right.
Often it really is.
And often, exactly. That's my kind of proposition is always just get more cynical about everybody. But for when you're talking about...
It's hard to lose that way.
Yeah. When you're talking about a right-wing petrostate, all of a sudden you trust them when they... So anyways, the point being, as I finish that little rant about just how relentlessly stupid people get about this stuff, the thing is that one of those other concerns on this sort of, you know, the kind of dumb left on Twitter is, okay, if we keep talking about this Russia stuff, won't there be like a, you know, this could lead to another Cold War? And, you know, I think there are some people who, I mean, we do have terrible relations with Russia, and there are people who do want us to escalate that way. But ironically, part of putting all this heat around this issue is another roadblock, as you were saying before, to this really dangerous and potentially realizable strategy of isolating Iran and Russia. So by actually keeping the heat on that, and again, you know, Russia's what took out Michael Flynn, and Michael Flynn was a guy who clearly was, you know, quite goal set. Like he had his like bench press goals for the year and invade Iran. And, right, you know, exactly. That didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's so much at this point. It's just like I feel like I'm always a day behind.
Sure.
On all the nonsense that comes out about and you know, a lot of it is genuine stuff. I mean, some of it is the Russia stuff is a lot of speculation, it seems to me, and very problematic in some ways. But, you know, the actual factual things that we learn about some of the people around Trump are, you know, plenty alarming in their own right.
Yeah. And maybe have actually hurt this, you know, potential strategy that we saw them trying to devise in the Seychelles, which would be great and ironic. The final kind of general question I have for you, maybe you could just sort of give us a primer on both sides, because, you know, obviously Trump campaigned against the Iran deal. He didn't know what was in the Iran deal. He doesn't know what he's talking about. You had Mike Flynn, who had a very specific, you know, hawk plan for Iran. What's happening basically inside the Trump administration and inside Iran? You know, the deal is still in place. So what's kind of happening mechanically and practically with that right now? On both sides,
The big activity around the Iran deal right now is happening in Congress. Actually, you know, the administration on a lot of things, not just Iran. I mean, there were, you know, things related to Israel, Palestine,
right,
as well. They kind of came into office, you know, the whole transition period. They were sort of gung ho about we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, and they haven't done much of any of it. They sort of run into the wall of reality that you can't do things like move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and you can't do things like tear up an agreement that you reached with, you know, six other countries.
Right.
So they've kind of hit that wall, and I think they're struggling not just to figure out, you know, how to proceed, but also because the other problem that they have is that they're, you know, they're extraordinarily understaffed for an administration, you know, almost 3 months, or, you know, in its third month. So they don't have a lot of people to think about these things. But in the Senate right now, there's a bill called the Countering Iran's Destabilizing Activities Act of 2017 that Bob Corker and Robert Menendez have co-sponsored.
Great.
Yeah.
Right.
So what this bill would do is basically try to resurrect a lot of the sanctions that were dropped or that were lifted or, you know, not permanently lifted, but have been, you know, sort of temporarily lifted and, you know, have to be, that has to be renewed, under the terms of the nuclear deal. And this would be an absolute violation of the nuclear deal. I mean, there are strict, you know, the United States is allowed to continue sanctioning Iran for human rights violations, for its missile program, for things that aren't related to the nuclear program. But it's not allowed to take, you know, basically the same sanctions that it had in place over the nuclear program and just reinstate them under different rationales.
Right.
So this would be a serious violation of the deal. At the same time, I think the bill also designates the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is Iran's elite military unit, designates them as a terrorist group, which is another extraordinarily bad idea. You know, the terrorist designations have never, you know, when they were created, were never meant to apply to state actors, and it raises all sorts of problems about, you know, how much can you, if you designate the IRGC as a terrorist group, can you have any interaction with Iran going forward that isn't military, basically?
Right, right.
And in fact, and the odd thing is that the actual sanctions value of doing that is almost none, because we sanction the IRGC under a number of other different measures. So this is just
provocative. Fox News talking like, why is that called a terrorist group? I mean, they're terrorists. You know, that legislation produced for that interview moment.
It's provocation just to be provocative, basically.
Right.
So this is, you know, this is where most of the action is happening in Washington. And, you know, if it passes, and, you know, that's questionable at best. But if it passes, I certainly think that it would get Trump's attention.
Yeah. Right.
You know, it's right in line with his sort of, you know, we got to get tough on Iran. They're the bad guys. The Obama administration was too soft on these guys. We have to, to reinstate the sort of hostile relationship that we've had with them since 1979. In Iran, the big, yeah. I mean, the big thing that's sort of encompassing everything in Iran is the upcoming presidential election, where the nuclear deal is being wielded as a cudgel against Hassan Rouhani, the incumbent. You know, he negotiated it. It was his sort of signature achievement. And a lot of Iranians feel like they haven't gotten the bang for the buck.
They were promised the kind of economic benefit for that deal. I mean, you know, the irony as we sign off, or the funny flip, is when Obama first came into office, he had the foil of Ahmadinejad just as like a brand. And then I think, you know, internationally, and then now, you know, Rouhani compared to Trump, you know, it's the flip. Now Iran has the Obama and we have the Ahmadinejad.
I mean, the perception, yeah, certainly.
In terms of the perception game, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they've got the guy who tried to reach out and, you know, build a relationship, and now we've got the guy who's pulling back and setting up, you know, lines in the sand.
I still think that Iran should just come out tomorrow and invite Trump to open up a luxury hotel in Tehran, and it would all be taken care of. But you know, I don't know why that hasn't happened yet.
I mean, that's actually not a crazy idea. Not that a luxury hotel, maybe, but you know, the Rex Tillerson, the fact that Rex Tillerson is Secretary of State, the CEO, you know, former CEO of Exxon, raises, you know, or it did at one point. I don't know if, you know, that's still a operative, but it raised the idea that, you know, hey, he's going to maybe recognize the value of you know, American energy companies getting involved in this market. So maybe he won't be. Now, you know, what we've learned in the past 2 months is that Rex Tillerson's role in this administration is, it, like, nobody knows what it is. It's subordinate to Jared Kushner.
Right.
So, you know, who knows how much influence he actually has.
It's like, on the phone with my dad, we're talking about a new condo in Hoboken. Anyways, Rex, do you think you could, like... That's awesome.
But, like, I mean, the economic angle would seem to be the way to get Trump on board with this. Like, you know, we can all make some money here.
Yeah, that seems like the answer. Derek Davidson, foreign policy analyst. You can find him at, what's your website?
It's attwiw.com.
All right. Well, we'll definitely be a link on our website, because no one, I'm sure a few people will, well, some people will remember that, and good for them, but we'll promote that. There's also on Loeb blog, we have a link to your Twitter. Everybody should really follow Derek Davidson. Great, great foreign policy stuff. I really appreciate your time, man, and I'll be in touch.
Thanks.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you.
We will be right back with Corey Pine. We're going to talk a little bit about Silicon Valley delusions and the dark enlightenment on the Majority Report.
It's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication lead to complication. My emancipation, don't fit your equation. I was on the humble, you on every station. Someone play young Lauren like she done. But remember not to game the one of the sun. Everything you did has already been done. I know all the tricks from bricks to kingdom. My kingdom, major kingdom, one run. Now understand El Boogie, not violent. But if a thing test me, run for me, gun. Can't take a threat to me, newborn. Been this way since creation. A groupie call you far from temptation. Now you want ball over separation. Tarnish my image in the conversation. Who you gonna scrimmage like you the champion? You might win some, but you just lost one. You might win some, but you just lost one. You might win some, but you just lost one. You might win some, but you just lost one. You might win some, but you just lost one. Now, how come your talk turned cold? Gain the whole world for the price of your soul.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Corey Pine. He is a journalist, contributor at The Baffler and many other publications. He has a forthcoming book on Silicon Valley, and the working title is
Live Work, 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 Die.
Live Work, 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 Die. Corey, there's a couple of things that I wanted to touch with you, talk with you about, because I think because of this book and the reporting you've been doing for several years, you are someone who can keep kind of connecting these dots in terms of the myth of Silicon Valley some of the sort of darkest, most dangerous myths of Silicon Valley and those who run it and preside over it, how those myths are actually quite synchronized with the Trump administration. And then, you know, we've had conversations about the alt-right and, you know, the misogynist, racist web and everything. But there's a lot of different sort of disgusting currents in this ecosystem. And one term that has not been discussed on the show that really provides an anchor for understanding everything from this resurgence of pseudoscientific racism online to even the relationship specifically between Bannon and Trump is something called the Dark Enlightenment. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, really, the Dark Enlightenment is much like red pill philosophy or, you know, pickup artistry.
Explain all that stuff, too. Not everybody's going to know.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. No, yeah. It's some made-up BS by, right. You know, insecure nerds. Largely, we're talking about software engineers. You know, and the important thing to understand about software engineers, it's not like being a civil engineer. You don't have to learn physics or chemistry or, like, high-level math. You learn, like, keyboard shortcuts and...
Shots fired.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid so. And, yeah. You know, there's a problem in these engineering curriculums. You get people that are obsessed with efficiency, obsessed with their own prowess, don't have a broad education or understanding of the world, and they really imagine that they would run things better on their own than all the other morons, you know, they're forced to share space with on the planet.
Right.
And that's the sort of mentality that creates some of these. So scientific racism, I mean, we're talking about essentially eugenics rebranded,
right?
With language like human biodiversity. It's kind of an interesting take on PC language for really old, disgusting right-wing ideas. Pickup artistry, I'm sure your listeners are familiar mm-hmm. with. It's mm-hmm. this, you know, like game theory for getting laid for guys that never do.
Okay. You're hitting the descriptions very well here.
The red pill is sort of a catch-all term borrowed from The Matrix, which is a favorite movie for many people in these online subcultures. And it refers to, you know, taking the red pill from Lawrence Fishburne and having your eyes
even
open
though he's out. Black.
Even though he's black.
Okay,
but,
all right.
I guess, you know, he's okay because he's good with computers. I don't know.
Yeah, okay, got it.
Everybody's got to have, like, one black friend to prove they're not racist. And so I guess for in these circles, like, Lawrence Fishburne in The Matrix fills that role.
I was thinking, like, they could rewrite it and Lawrence Fishburne would say things, like, in that character where he's just like, I'm committed to the free and open exchange of ideas, Neo. I have no problem with acknowledging general disparities in IQ testing, even though I have an exceptionally high IQ. That's the problem with the matrix of political correctness.
You could be a forum mod on one of these things and read it very
that's
quickly.
The most insulting thing anybody's ever said to me. Okay, keep going. Yeah, no, it's great. Oh, go ahead.
Well, so, yeah, all these things sort of unite, and the Dark Enlightenment is an offshoot, and it's a little bit more of a unified theory of the alt-right, even though I don't really like that term. It's become sort of standardized now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little more philosophical in its bent, and I stumbled across it, I guess, around 2013, 2014. There was a TechCrunch article called Geeks for Monarchy, and it was a pretty good overview of this weird Dark Enlightenment subculture, and it identified a couple of bloggers who I wrote about in my Baffler piece.
Which is called The Mouth-Breathing Machiavelli's Dream of a Silicon Reich.
Yes, I've never gotten so much mileage out of an article.
Yeah, it was a good title.
Well, a couple of the key... bloggers were, there's a British academic who moved to Shanghai called Nick Land, and he's really obsessed with, like, this pseudo-scientific racism called human biodiversity, and he believes that, you know, the Chinese are a superior civilization, and,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's for biological reasons. It's all the old eugenics stuff. from, you know, the early mid 20th century that led to a lot of horrors of that time. And another one is a guy who goes by the pseudonym of Mencius Moldbug, but his real name is Curtis Yarvin.
Actually, I would go with Mencius Moldbug in that case.
Yeah,
he's actually right.
I never figured out where Moldbug was from, but Mencius was like the
Chinese ancient, like court philosopher or something.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
So he's telegraphing his erudition with references like this. And I really focus more on Moldbug because I think he was more influential. And, you know, he ran a blog that had maybe, it was pretty obscure in a number sense. You know, it had maybe 100,000 readers over its lifetime, which was maybe 6 years ending 2015 or so.
Mm-hmm.
But among those readers were some very influential people, including, I suspect, Peter Thiel, but also definitely a fellow named Patrick Friedman, who is the grandson of the economist Milton Friedman of the Chicago School.
Right.
And that would be nothing of note, except for the content of this blog, which really solidified this Dark Enlightenment philosophy, which, again, is made up BS. But it's a way, it was a term he made up to argue in very flowery language that, you know, blacks are better under apartheid, that, you know, monarchy is superior to democracy, that the U.S. should be reestablished as a kind of corporate dictatorship, perhaps multiple corporate dictatorships. For reasons of efficiency and whatnot, and to argue that Germany was acting in its own defense in the Second World War, all sorts of ideas that if you took them out of context and stated them simply, you would be able to recognize as essentially fascist ideas.
Right.
But here we have this sort of red pill, dark enlightenment online subculture. Reframing them in a new way and talking about them in a new way and pitching it specifically to like the great numbers of alienated, young, tech savvy, gamery type men online.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about this, and just to sort of reset a little bit. So we have all of these various subcommunities that essentially in different forms tell you that whatever your frustration may be, maybe you're Peter Thiel and you're frustrated that you can't just, you know, pick poor kids off of the street and biodegrade them to blood to, you know, lengthen your lifespan because government gets in the way. And that
free market should allow that.
Right.
Really.
Exactly. Maybe that bothers you. Or maybe on the other hand, you're unemployed from your last coding job and you haven't had sex in a couple of years and you're angry, right? So that there's this whole scale of grievance from this that could, you know, even though they're entirely different, the sort of ultimate plutocrat and someone who's actually a loser in the current economic system could sort of coalesce around because the problem is women, people of color, political correctness, blah, blah, blah. But because it's in a culture that values or supposedly values rationality, efficiency, futurism, you in order to make these sort of like blood and soil arguments, you need to put a sort of tech garnish over them and reconstitute and say old stories in a new way. So it's, you know, instead of this sort of like, you know, classic founding of American, you know, racism that, you know, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, things are, black people are meant to do, you know, physical labor. And that's why we can do, you know, we can mass kidnap, murder, and enslave them. And then in the current situation, it becomes like, well, you know, if you look at test scores, we really realize that, like, you know, Singaporeans should be running the world. But it's the same, you know, as you're saying, it's the same kind of thought process of ancient ideas about great chains of being, natural hierarchies, eugenics, and of course, like all these other systems when you're writing something in make-believe, you always come out on top. But the other important thread that you've identified is that the two different audiences that are relating to this could be the dissatisfied young guy who is not living a good life, even though they're still probably relatively privileged because, you know, their experience of unemployment is sitting around and trolling, you know, these weird forums all day. They have an excuse and a justification and an explanation and targets of blame. On the other end, what you have is you have, this weird cadre of bloggers actually writing directly to audiences of people like Peter Thiel, who are, you know, obviously multi-billionaires, and almost pitching themselves as the potential, as you say, the kind of mouth-breathing Machiavellis, the moron Confucius of what could be some new fascist technocracy. And this was always deeply disturbing, but it always seemed a little bit out there, you know, like, okay, how is that actually going to look? But then we have, you know, a very weird and atypical demographic representation of this, kind of in the relationship of Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. We have a clown fascist and a guy who created the, you know, tabloid version of all these other arguments, and also a guy who's, you know, a big fan of Sun Tzu.
Well, you raise a lot of deeply disturbing stuff there. I will say that when I wrote this article for The Baffler in 2014, I expected it to be like, hey, here's some weird stuff going on we should keep an eye on, you know. Mm-hmm. And so even after I finished the first draft of my book a couple years later, I wasn't expecting to see these people in power so quickly. And here's the thing. I mean, Thiel was subsidizing this guy Moldbug's blog by funding his startup, which is essentially a dead-end startup with no product. So he's been able to carry on intellectually spreading this stuff because of Thiel's largesse.
Right.
And because of his seeming incompetence as an investor. And Thiel wound up, of course, on Trump's transition team.
Right.
Introduced some other Silicon Valley people who subscribe to this philosophy, like Balaji Srinivasan, who's been talked about as an FDA appointee in the Trump administration and echoes a lot of Moldbug-style rhetoric, really bringing them into the administration. And he also seems to have, or someone introduced Moldbug to Steve Bannon. Mm-hmm. Politico did an article earlier this year about Steve Bannon's reading list, and on it was this blogger mentions Moldbug, the dark enlightenment dork, you know, which is mind-blowing to me, and should be disturbing if you look at the kind of things that Moldbug's actually writing about. I mean, he said one of his quotes that always sticks out in my mind is he said something like, you know, if you want me to condemn Andrew Breivik and yet give Nelson Mandela a pass, then, you know, fuck you, basically.
Wow. Right.
And it doesn't get any clearer than that.
Right.
You know, in terms of the mentality that we're talking
about. In terms of who these people are. Then,
yeah.
As a final, we'll have many more conversations about this moving forward, but I think that this is important because it kind of situates some things that are, there's all of these really bizarre ideas that have been at the margins that unfortunately now we all need to track and be attentive to in the Trump era and moving forward. But the last question, and I know this will get to your book and obviously have you on when the book comes out. In the last 30 seconds or so, I mean, do you think that opening the lens up more broadly, because there's obviously much more benign versions of Silicon Valley politics, which are also problematic, but it, you know, the Democratic version, which after you get dip into this stuff for a little while, I'm ready for a, hey, I'd like a more diverse board of directors on my sandwich ordering app. Actually seems pretty nice. But it's still a very impoverished view of politics and the economy. Do you think in order to undermine these ideas, we need to undermine the Silicon Valley myth in general? Because when we've cultivated that myth, that's allowed even people, you know, and Peter Thiel's the kind of obvious example, but there's many others of these, you know, frankly, very deranged and dangerous people to sort of just get this pass because they're in the mythos of our new romantic site of capitalism.
Yes, there's more overlap between the seemingly benign version of the Silicon Valley ideology and the extremist, you know, neo-fascist version that I've just been talking about.
Right.
And there's a difference between what some of the people that are seemingly more respectable than someone like Thiel say in public and what they say in private. Mm-hmm. And you can go, you know, just go to some conferences. I mean, I spent like a year doing that, and I was a little shaken by some of what I heard from people who are, you know, not necessarily the raving open racists like Thiel, Moldbug, and this crew. You know, when Google still wants to put brain implants in people so they can pipe advertising straight in there. You know, these are ideas. I first got onto this topic because Google hired Ray Kurzweil. And if you've read anything that Kurzweil has written, you know it's pretty out there stuff. And I thought, why did they hire him to be director of engineering? What does that mean about their plans and the way they see the world and their place in it?
Right.
Even Elon Musk, who's sort of even a hero to many liberals because he's seemingly environmentalist. I mean, his vision of the future is all the rich white people go to Mars.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. And that's what Chronic said. What are you going to do when the whole world becomes a ghetto and you're not able to fly to Mars? So, as always, reggae's ahead of the curve, as are you, Corey Pine. The article is Mouth-Breathing Machiavelli's Dream of a Silicon Reich, which was in Baffler in 2014. The book is Live, Work, Work, Die.
Or was three it? Works.
Three works. Yeah, that makes sense. Why stop?
No slacking.
Yeah, no slacking. This is a time of real accountability and opportunity. Corey, as always, I really appreciate your time, and I'll talk with you soon.
Thanks, man. Hey, can I get a plug for my soon-to-be-launched podcast for The Baffler?
No, get off the phone. Yeah, no, of course. Okay. Go ahead. Tell.
Yeah, well, it'll launch in a couple of weeks. I'll be sure to have you on. It's called News from Nowhere. And maybe you could return the favor of getting me on the Ken, Ken, and Ken show.
I don't know anything about that. I did. There's a guy, Scotso, that I get drunk with when I go back to Mass sometimes. So maybe I could ask you about that. I ask him about that.
My probation officer said I could complete my community service by calling in and doing a formal public apology.
That sounds awesome. All right. Everybody follow Corey. All links on the site. Looking forward to your pod, too, and very much looking forward to being on it. All right, man. Take care.
Later.
Bye. Okay. We are going to go to the fun half. Where? We are going to take your phone calls. We're going to talk about Sebastian Gorka and Jared Kushner going to Iraq. Like how insulting it is for everybody, from like military State Department planners to like the Iraqis, that you're just like, yeah, this guy.
The amount of people His dad owns real estate. Annoyed by all this stuff is...
It's just so innately insulting. I mean, it's like, it would be annoying enough if you were an editor at the New York Observer, and this kid came on and you were like, well, I mean, he's who's paying the bills, I guess. This is ridiculous, but what am I going to do? But then in like the third meeting where you're actually getting strategic advice from him, that would annoy you. Let alone, imagine like you're sitting down with the Iraqi... some Iraqi ministers, and it's like, we need, to position this, or Mosul will fall. It's just like, oh, yeah, it's just like, you know, what Dad said, but we're trying to knock down a condo in Newark. Join the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys and a podcast. Definitely check out the JustCoffee.coop deal. It's 30% off of the MR blend, and I believe it is MR Spring 17, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. See you in the fun half.